Go Wild is a free social community created for and by hunters. This means that unlike mainstream social media, your trophy pictures won't be censored. They're encouraged. As you spend time on Go Wild, you will earn awesome rewards such as gift cards, free swag, and big discounts on brands like Garmin and Vortex. You will even earn $10 just for signing up. Visit downloadgowild.com and sign up today.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. For some of you, this has been gun season. The introduction to gun season has happened. Gun season is on the horizon for me. My hunting season has been really productive. I've been really pleased. My property has been highly productive. A lot of deer, a lot of young deer I have not killed. I'm okay with that. And I'm just strategizing for the future. I'm into the swing of things with clients. I start clients here in just a few weeks. And I got tons of reports to still get done. So I'm behind on my workload. And I say that because, you know, we get wrapped up in all these different activities, whether it's hunting, spending time with family, holidays are coming up. And, you know, you got to prioritize what's important. Obviously, my business is important and making sure my clients are happy as well. But, you know, it's taking the time to look at information that you have in front of you and starting to assess what you need to do next. I'm really excited because we have a gentleman coming on this podcast today that he's not a regular. He's not one of our standard guys that comes on this because I wanted to kind of expand a little bit people that we talk to get more information to help us try to assess our environments at kind of a different level. He's a data guy and I'm a data guy. So let me get him on the line real quick. Hey, Bill, are you on the phone?
I'm here. How you doing?
Oh, great. Okay, so we got Bill Thompson on the phone. He's with Spartan Fords. Some of you are familiar with the app. It's been, I think, Bill, would you say this app has been a progressive app? You've kind of come out with iterations of it, and it's kind of more in a, I don't know, finalized stage, and I'm sure it's across the country because I got buddies that are using it.
Yeah, so the app came out about a year ago, and we're definitely iterating, and we have actually some more features coming out here pretty soon. I'd say we're about 75% to where we want the application to be, and then we'll be adding things here and there, but there's a couple of other key features we'll be releasing. But yeah, it's pretty much getting close. A couple things you got to do, but it's close.
Yeah, that's good. And we're not going to maybe dive into the app too much, but I think some of the intel related to that is really critical. So I'm going to get a little background on you. I remember you being an intel analyst in the Air Force. Is that correct?
I was in the Army. Yeah, I was an intelligence analyst in the Army doing multiple disciplines of intelligence collection, signals intelligence, cyber, on-net operation stuff, human intelligence, and a couple of other things, but those are the main ones. I did that as an enlisted guy for about 10 years and as a warrant officer for about 10 years, just basically like a technician. But yeah, my focus was intelligence operations in the military.
Yeah, that's cool. All those ints, humits, all those different defensive type mindsets. I'm a bit familiar with that. I've got some friends and family in those type of industries, and so I've got a bit of familiarity. But it's funny because that really correlates to some of the data analytics stuff that you've done with the deer. And I want to hear about kind of, you know, some of the information that you've evaluated over the years and what you've looked at and building this app that you came up with, how you've kind of, so there's two different strategies. Ones could be, you know, you're looking at the information and movement as it relates to, well, we'll just say weather, for example. And you've taken, I think, a little step further than that. There's much more information landscape wise, and you're really diagnosing a lot more information for, you know, hunters to understand kind of what the ranges of movement are, which is a little bit unique to a lot of these other apps that are out there. So can you give a little background on kind of how you got to where you're at today?
Yeah, so it's been a long road. There's multiple ways I can tackle that question, but I guess I'll start with kind of the first way I tried to do it was I built a sensor network for a property that I hunt out in the Midwest. And what I mean by that is I set up just like accelerometers, which are essentially, you know, vibration sensors, and some cameras that I wired up with weather vanes. And I had access to this property that I knew really well. So on that property, I just set up cameras everywhere where I knew there were historical scrapes, where I knew there were rubs, where I knew there was bedding. Set all of this stuff up, and for almost 2 years, I had everything pushing to a computer, and then it would go to the AWS, and I would look through the data, and I would kind of try to get an understanding of how deer use the property and what days are active on using the property and that type of stuff. And, you know, it became evident to me I could do a little bit of prediction on the property, but there were things still that I was missing. And from there, I kind of stopped the sensor stuff, and I had put together essentially like a white paper.
Yep.
And I went to some deer biologists that I knew of that were doing collared deer data. And that to me was more an accurate representation of actual movement. So everyone kind of builds models off of observational data. And observational data is flawed, and it's because it's observational data. You know, a human comes to the table with bias, and, you know, if you're trying to watch deer or look at deer, or you're trying to use cameras to nail down a pattern or trying to learn something from deer, it's just, you know, if you have your head down your phone and deer crosses the field, then you've missed a movement vector. And so there's a lot of problems with all of that. So the GPS data to me was the obvious way to do it, because with the GPS data, you can look at the terrain they're going through. You can look at the mapping. You can look at the weather. You can correlate the movement with weather events. But then more importantly, you can look at the data over time. Deer rarely do things because something just happened. In other words, if a storm comes tomorrow, that data, storm is here, is not enough data to make a prediction with. And that's another thing that these observational models use, is they just say, oh, there's rising pressure and there's a storm coming next week, and therefore there's going to be deer movement. But the more accurate way to look at that is to actually look at what deer movement's been like for the past 3 months, to look at what weather events there are. Is there a drought? What's been going on with the deer population? Is CWD coming through? Is there something impacting the herd? Are coyotes on the rise? All of those data points make for a more accurate model that can more accurately predict deer movement. So the way to think about it would be, and if I can contextualize it for a human, is just, you know, if I'm trying to figure out how much food a human is eating in a day, you could say, well, anytime the human hasn't eaten a meal, he's going to eat more in the next meal. And that might work for like a small scale model. You might be able to predict, you know, how often does John eat? John eats whenever John eats more. Whenever he misses a meal, he's missed lunch. Therefore, we think he's going to eat more at dinner. A more accurate model would be looking at what your calorie load has been, what your workload has been, how often are you going to the gym, how many steps do you take in a day, and then how many meals have you had in the past 2 weeks, or what is your metabolism like? All of these other variables get fed in, and then now what we have is a much more accurate model, and that will predict much better across time and will be much less likely to be incorrect, and that's what we do with the deer data on Spartan Forge.
I love the way you laid that out. And to bring the contextual aspect of it, to understand that it's evolved and it's more involved for that matter, I think people miss out on that because the observational... All right, I'm just going to be frank with you. Some of the information that I look at when I'm deciding to go after a deer specifically is his individual characteristics. And I know this is taking kind of a broad brush stroke at multiple, you know, deer, male, females, what have you, over multiple, you know, terrains and locations, et cetera. But, you know, there's very, like, specifics that individual deer information that they reveal in their movement patterns, if you can observe them. Now, I'm observing them with camera data, not GPS collars. But you have some cadence and understanding of that. And there's factors of, you know, their interest levels in an area, the volume of food, you know, there's their health conditions at that time. There's all these factors that kind of play into that. That's much more involved than we're just talking about a weather system coming through. And I think people may not take that into account, and they may buy into some of these other apps, and I'm not trying to do comparisons or blow somebody out of the water, but I don't pay attention to that, those bits of information on some of these other apps, just because, I mean, it's par for the course. Weather systems are either going to help or hinder deer movement. I mean, that's a kind of broad brush statement, but it's the reality of things. I've seen that time and time again, but that doesn't mean that individual deer will react the same way. And every individual deer will act that way to the weather systems for that matter. So I think it's very individualistic beyond kind of this GPS collar data. So I want to kind of add to your point.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we will never build a model that will predict for a deer. That's not a market segment that I think could become is even feasible. And deer have personalities, and there are deer that do more movement and less movement. And the challenge of the machine is to understand what is normal for this app, for this deer. So you might have two deer. So one deer that moves, let's say, 1,000 yards in a 24-hour period, and another one that moves 3,000 yards in a 24-hour period. The job of the neural network is to look at those two deer as individuals and determine kind of what their range of movement is, and then what creates the ebbs and flows in that, and then apply that to a herd of deer that you have information on to make general predictions. Deer rarely do things at the same time. So I kind of laugh when I see some of these other prediction apps where it's like, hey, 9 a.m. tomorrow morning is going to be the best hunting for your area. The type of data that would be needed for that, and the type of empirical science and research that would have to undergird that. I mean, you'd need 10,000 drones in the air looking at every deer across the U.S. And then, but what you would quickly figure out is that deer don't do that. There's not going to be ever a model that's going to have any type of scientific rigor that's going to say, hey, all of your deer are going to be moving tomorrow afternoon, which is why we use the bucket system that we use, which is essentially, will they be in their bedding areas? Will they be in transition during daylight hours, or will they be in their full range? And that model only gets, from a scientific perspective, only about 63% accuracy, because these are wild animals we're dealing with. And there's too many things happening at the tail ends of the distribution that doesn't make it useful or even practical to try to predict that. So we do the best we can do with prediction across about 2,000 years of collared deer data to tell hunters, generally, this is what you can expect out of the population. Now, that it does work, and it works, you know, 60 to 70% of the time, depending on the deer. But you're always going to have deer that are individuals. You're always going to have factors that can't be accounted for in the neural network that are driving movement. And really what I'm trying to do with our neural network is just give somebody a point of contact on not if or when they should hunt, but just if you have a day to hunt, go hunt. But here's, you know, you can look at our neural network and it'll give you a sense of how aggressive you should try to be, unless you are focusing on an individual that you've got a pretty good rundown on, or like a target profile on, and you understand its tendencies. It basically is just, okay, I've got a core area day. It means that I need to be closer to bedding. I need to try to get aggressive and get close to bedding, because it's not likely that I'm going to be able to sit a field edge and see a deer today. The general population is doing X, Y, or Z. So that to me is the interesting science. And then the other part about it is, you know, deer don't just move for an hour, or there's not just like a best hour of movement, or there's not a best period time of the day of movement. It's more of a general trend over days of even weeks. You'll have, you know, a week or two where deer movement is low, and then a week or two where it's high, because a lot of people will question, they'll see the network predictions and they'll be like, wow, dude, it looks like there's going to be great movement in my place for a week, you know. And we're kind of programmed by these other apps to kind of say, oh, movement's only going to be good for an hour tomorrow, or it's going to be good for 3 hours tomorrow, or this is the best time of the day.
Right.
Again, I kind of went into why that's not practical to try to program things that way. But then secondly, the things that are driving deer movement, whether that's, you know, a hunger hormone, ghrelin signaling that you're low on fat, or there's a breeding season coming up, or there is a drought, none of those things are alleviated with an hour or two of movement. If you've got a drought, deer are going to be moving more than they normally would be for water, or staying closer to water for many weeks on end. Or if you've got a breeding season, when you compare movement during breeding seasons to movement outside of breeding seasons, it's as if the deer don't move when you compare. Like a buck will be covering, you know, I've got bucks on live GPS in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida, where I can look up their movements at any time of the day and see how long they're moving. You know, during the rut, it's not unheard of for have a buck move 10 or 15 miles in one day. Mm-hmm. And then during the early summer when they're bachelored up, you might only get 700 yards of movement out of them out of a 24-hour period. So, and the reasons for that, when you're informing a model, then it then the model starts to make sense. It's like, okay, here's why I have so many full range days in a row, or I have so many core area days in a row, is because deer are responding to an environment that's driving them to do one thing or another. And often those reasons aren't satiated because they went out and moved for an hour. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to go back on a couple of things, but the interesting piece of this is the full range, you know, and the predictive modeling piece of that, where, you know, what is the information that's really driving that? I mean, these deer have obviously collars on them. They're going from location to location to location, but there's always a purpose behind the movement. Obviously breeding is the most obvious. What other factors have you kind of, you've had to generalize to some degree. It could be hunting pressure, right? It could be other factors that are, it could be predation. There are factors that make them move in those instances. Have you kind of started to lay out, like, just, you know, appreciation of all those factors in this so people understand what those might be? I mean,
It really depends on where you're talking. There's no one model. We use, I think right now we have like 11 or 12 different regionalized models based on our GPS data. What get deer moving in the Midwest is not what gets deer moving in the Southeast. As a point of contact, humidity contributes greatly to deer movement in the Southeast. And it's not a level of humidity, it's humidity change. It's the delta between the initial state and the prior state.
Yeah.
Of humidity. So if humidity is rising or falling, that tends to get deer moving in the Southeast. Whereas in the Midwest, where I have lots of data, it's not really even a factor on the list. Humidity doesn't get a vote like it does in the Southeast. Flooding in the Southeast as well, and rainfall. If someone were to ask me what is the number one thing I should focus on in the Southeast when it comes to deer hunting and seeing deer, it's hunt when there's low, light rain. Light rain really gets deer moving in the Southeast. Light rain does not get deer moving in the Midwest or in the Northeast like it does get them moving in the Southeast. Cold snaps. People always say, oh, you know, there's a front coming, so deer are going to be moving. That heuristic works sometimes, but it's more accurate to be like when you've had a pattern of storms. What I see a lot of times in the deer data in the Northeast, especially in the Midwest, is a lot of your mature animals will sit out the first cold snap, and they'll just on their belly, especially if they've got access to food or if there's a good acorn crop that year, and there's lots of fat. They will just... They kind of see... I imagine, I don't know this because the deer don't answer
the polling questions.
Surveys.
Yeah, the survey.
But a lot of mature deer will sit out the first snowstorm of the year or the 2 or 3 day snowstorm of the year because I imagine they see it as kind of like a time of instability and it's changing their environment. And they kind of want to learn the environment the new environment before they get crazy. So whereas you'll see a lot of bucks and does, small bucks and does will be moving a lot for every storm, your older deer will not. And that definitely has an impact on the model. So you'll see a lot. Now, what you will see is on the third or fourth big storm of the year, when that pressure starts to rise and the temperature starts to fall, then you will start to see all of the deer in a population start to move. But that's only after the first two or three storms have affected the amount of fat stores that they have on. So yeah. Those are like some common things that as I go through the data that I see, you know, and so some of the tropes that we have based around deer movement are sort of informed. But there's a lot more context there before you start to understand the reasons of why the thing is actually happening, the causality behind it, beyond just temperature is falling.
Yeah, I think diagnosing the causality, as you just stated, it's variable. And it's interesting, the predictive modeling piece of this is you're taking an effect and analyzing this data at a very fine level and finding trends to some degree to help your predictive modeling. And this is difficult for people to understand because, again, you're kind of looking at these populations at a macro level, so to speak, right? I'm assuming you're presuming deer of average health, and there's instances where deer fall outside of that, right? Some are superior, some are less superior, but then the movement patterns, I think, which is most critical right now, is you know what are the jaunts and distances these deer are moving on an average basis. That's probably all over the place, and it's probably very specific to the herd dynamics and the amount of deer available in those landscapes, and on top of that, their personalities and preferences. What are you seeing? I mean, like, can you give me some examples of maybe just modeling that you've looked at, maybe an individual deer, their distances that they've moved, and maybe a trend of certain deer in certain areas, and just some information on that, because people are interested in, you know, is my deer moving 10 miles away that I was tracking 2 weeks ago, is he moving, you know, 50 miles or 5 miles, or what, maybe some averages so people have some an idea.
Yeah, so it's really that those the numbers that you're asking for there really drive to personality of the deer. Mm-hmm. Does seem to be more general in that regard, but when you're coming to like specific deer, the question gets answered better when you know like what is the time of year that this is happening? Are there does standing? Is there mating happening? Is it the late season? What's the season been like? But, you know, on average, like during the rut, you know, I'm recalling, I believe it was a study that I had done down in Alabama, but I had bucks on that same property during the rut that kind of had like competing rut tactics. One rut tactic of the bucks that I saw year after year on certain bucks was they would follow individual doe groups and just wait for the doe group to come into heat. Now that guy, would not be moving that much in a day. Maybe, you know, I say that much, but it's still the rut. So he's still moving between 1 and 3 miles during daylight hours, which, you know, for a buck is a lot during that time of the year. But then you'll have these other bucks that will be just winding, you know, they'll get downwind of does and working scrapes, and they'll be going doe group to doe group. Those guys, I can see those guys move between 10 and 15 miles in a day. Yeah. Because they're basically running and checking every doe group that they know of. So it's really a spectrum of movement. But it's having that type of data driven approach can kind of help you understand the individual movement patterns associated with those bucks. That comes down to personality. But during the early season, you know, it's far less movement. You could think of it this way, lower amounts of movement in a smaller area. But then if you can find that area, those deer become very huntable. But then as you get to the rut, the range gets larger, and the ability for multiple people to see that buck across multiple properties increases. But there's not really like a hard and fast number across the U.S. I believe you're up in Pennsylvania. Those are some of the largest numbers. Deer that we have tagged, there's a military base and armory that we have tagged deer at. Though it's not uncommon to see those deer do between 7 and 10 miles a day.
Yeah, and I think it's
during this time of year.
I didn't expect to have an exact number out of you, of course, but you know, it's interesting to know that there's a trend, and that trend deviates over time from what's standard, and it's seasonal, right? Because of the breeding cycle. All right, I want to ask a more specific question. And I think a lot of people pay attention to this. I pay attention to this from just camera data, right? So that's just purely observation data. Timing of movement. So, you know, NDA came out with a study, you know, most deer are moving, you know, morning and night at certain intervals of time, right? And I see that to be a trend, obviously, during certain periods of time, right? Seasonality that obviously affects their eating cycles, depending on this type of food that they have in their locations, will also change that movement pattern and cycle. But in this time, like right specific, we're talking early November, mid-November, late November, into that breeding cycle period. Are you noticing deer take breaks? Are a lot of deer resting at certain intervals? Are you finding trends, or is there any instances where they're moving all day long? They're not stopped moving. I mean, they're wearing their body down tremendously. I mean, you're seeing probably trends both ways, but do you see deer taking breaks and resting themselves? Now, it could be conditional, right? They need to thermoregulate. They need to find, you know, landscape preferences that may help benefit them from a breeding or analysis cycle where they can find those resident does. But you know, I'm wondering if you're finding data and trends where they don't move all the time, or some instances they're moving quite frequently. And this correlates directly to the way you've contextualized this into kind of transition bedding. And then the third one was, full range movement. So I kind of want to get some more intel on how you've categorized things, and does that relate to kind of trends of movement that you're seeing on the landscape?
Yeah, so specifically speaking to bucks, during this time of the year, it is really depending on what the doe are doing and the tactic that that buck is using, whether he's just going doe group to doe group, or he is the technique where we talked about before, where he's tracking individual does. In that case, in both of those cases, though, the buck that is going group to group is traveling much more. The buck that is following with those does could be traveling less. And really it boils down to seeing them paired up with does and following does. I do see, no matter what, and you alluded to this at the beginning, the majority of the movement is happening on, if you're looking at a 24-hour period, in the morning and in the afternoon at dusk. So during those two periods, are going to account for between 60 and 70% of the deer's overall movement throughout the day, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. So if you just, for instance, I'm going to say for sake of ease, that a deer moves 1,000 yards in a day, between the hours of a half hour before sunrise and sunset and a half hour before and after sunrise and sunset, 60 to 70% of their movement that buck or doe is going to make throughout the day is during those times. And that almost never changes except during the rut. And then if during the rut, but with the exception of some older bucks where I see that they're bedding down for the day and not competing in the first rut, which I've seen, especially in the South, I've seen a lot of that data, older bucks that just aren't competing as often in the rut, and they're competing more in the secondary rut than they are actually in the primary rut, which is an interesting thing all of its own. I think I could do a podcast on that on my own.
Yep.
But it's just the bucks are running, and they're running all of the time. I've got a lot of good data out of studies in the Southeast, in the Georgia area and the South Carolina area, where these deer are losing 45% of their physical mass during the rutting period. So this deer gets tagged with a GPS, and he weighs, 220 pounds, 230 pounds or something like that. And then they are, the collar is dropping, or they're guarding the deer again after the rutting season is over. And now we're talking February, March, and that deer is now 165, 170 pounds.
Yeah.
So those are just bucks that are running all of the time, and they just don't turn off, and they're constantly going. They will bed down and take breaks or whatever, especially if the doe is hot and they're on that doe. They'll take that opportunity to mull and eat or whatever. But for the most part, during, say about 2 weeks before the peak of the rut and about a week to 10 days after, it's pretty much go time for them. And they're moving as really often. Now, that's not saying you won't see individuals that are bedding, or you won't see that they're not bedding with the does, but they know it's their opportunity and they're running as much as they can.
Yeah, that's interesting. So this other trend that came up, people have talked about midday movement, and you've seen this hunting. I've seen this hunting where there's that midday movement and they're like, all right, that's an identifier that the breeding cycle is on. What's your theory and thought on that?
What is my theory about the midday movement?
Yeah, midday movement. And here's what I want to be clear on this. Large jaunt, so an expanded movement pattern versus just a small jaunt. And the difference there, because I think that's what people are observing. They're seeing expanded movement rather than contracted movement during these breeding phases and cycles. Have you noticed
absolutely.
Those trends?
Yeah, absolutely. I see the midday movement. I call it kind of like, I've been saying it to myself. Maybe I read this somewhere else, but I'm not sure. I kind of call it like the second shift. And I'll see it a lot, especially between like bucks of like 3 and 6 years old. That mid afternoon, again, they're checking the bedding. They're going around and looking for those hot does because, that time period is constricted. And I definitely see a lot of that midday movement. I mean, a lot of people will do like the all day rut stands. After seeing as much GPS data as I've seen, I don't do the all day rut stands. I will hunt all day, but I will be changing my sets and where I'm hunting. In the mornings, mornings and afternoons, I'll focus on those doe groups and getting downwind of those doe groups. And then what I do is I map out and trying to understand where all of the doe bedding areas are. And then during that midday shift, I'll be focusing on choke points, especially vegetative, not so much topographic, especially in pressured regions, the deer don't really use saddles like you think they would, or some of the other traditional features that people kind of build their hunts around.
Yep.
But they definitely stick to cover whenever they're trying to move in between these places. So, you know, I'll physically map it out on a map. And now this is, of course, I haven't really been doing any hunting for the past couple of years since I started this business. So when I did have the time, you know, I would mark out on my map in my area all of my doe beds. And I've been looking at the GPS data for about 8 years now. And I will focus on the heaviest cover that kind of gets bucks from A to Z in an area. And that's where I'll spend what I call the second shift, is sitting in between there where these bucks are kind of using this cover to get between doe bedding areas during the daylight hours. But definitely that is a thing that I'm seeing there. And then the second thing that I think is really interesting is almost all of your 3 to 7 year old bucks, the mature bucks that we have on a lot of this GPS data, will also engage between 1 to 3 excursions where they're just going totally off their pattern or their area, and they're traveling to a place where either they spent their years when they were young, before they were sexually mature, like their first 18 months, or just a totally random area where they go off. And that's kind of like when you start seeing these bucks that you've never seen before on your camera, if it's a buck that you want to kill, you need to key on them right away because they're probably not going to be in that area for long. So, they do these excursions.
Yeah. So this is an interesting data point, and I think a lot of people miss that. I'm going to go back to the one statement you did make about dense cover and then hunting. And we've talked about this from a design standpoint, how to design your property around these type of movements and focusing in transit. The other piece, this jaunting thing where deer goes off in these excursions, this is also a critical point. So when you're designing your hunting property, and I'll throw this in as a left field comment, I focus on with all my clients, continue to put attractive, we call it increasing the value of your property. So you're creating a high level attraction all season long, because you don't know when that deer has spent time, has interest, or has been on your property. And most people don't have that type of data, but trust me, those deer eventually come back to these properties that they may have been born on, or they may have spent some time on through the winter months in my area. Deer trying to have some migration type, you know, jaunts, essentially, because of snow load. They become preferential to some of these areas. So don't be, be mindful of the fact that information like this is relevant, because continue to create a value of, you know, a proposition for these deer to be on your property may lead to this random movement that day that you happen to be hunting on your property, that you become successful on a deer that maybe was there at one time or the other that you weren't aware of, that isn't your, you know, resident deer, so to speak. So I think that's an important bit of data, at least from a design standpoint.
Yeah, I agree. And like, you know, if I had two factors that I needed to focus on, I would focus on girls and cover. Food is almost tertiary in that regard. Like, I'll see in GPS studies, a lot of times deer bucks at night will travel a long way for food. That's not how they choose their bedding, and it's not really how they choose to spend their bedding during the day. I'm not saying they won't. It's obviously, if they're not pressured, they'll take whatever you give them. But when it comes down to, like, you know, there's three things that I focus on when I focus on deer and deer hunting, which is, you know, in the military, with, you know, when we start talking about tracking targets, we talk about screening, covering, and flow. Bucks kind of use the same thing, but it's bedding, covering, and bedding covers, cover, bedding, and girls, and then food. The food is kind of like the last thing on the list for me. You know, obviously you want to provide them food and you want to plant food, and if you can do that, do it. But if somebody's got like a small piece of property, I see bucks really hold to areas where there's great cover and great bedding, especially for the daylight hours. As the bucks get older and wiser, those are really things that they key on. And then when you actually get to walk through these areas where, which I've done a couple times now, where you start seeing these 6, 7, 8, 9 year old bucks hang out, it is just like, when you get to the area, you perfectly understand why they've selected it. And you almost get like a chill up your spine, because you're like, wow, this buck is almost impossible to kill because the way that he's erected this area that he's chosen. Yep. And then the second thing that is interesting about that, I think, is if that buck does get killed, there'll be another buck in there in a week or two, or maybe a month, because, you know, that's kind of like the prime bedding area. So when you can create those types of sanctuaries on your property where the bucks really feel comfortable, and they have that cover and that bedding, I know in my experience is hugely valuable. And then having girls.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fun the way that you broke that down. And we've talked on the other land managers that are part of this podcast have said something very similar to what we've just talked about. And Johnny Stewart's been on this, and we talked about those kind of areas that are not accessible, right? That are like keyed in on by these primary or in this case, more mature bucks. Part two of that is adding food into these bedding areas to make them highly attractive to, again, hold and attract deer. And food can be in different forms. We've talked about that on multiple podcasts. But it's thinking more intricately about these designs and layouts. And it's funny, your data is kind of proving that out. So I'm interested to probably talk more with you, Bill. And I think this is a great introduction to you. This is nice because you're not a sponsor of my podcast, and I don't have any sponsors on this podcast, but I want people to take a look at your app, and I want them to take a look at, you know, you gave some real factual bits of information of what we're looking at, and you're saying trending data, predictive modeling, and, you know, what probability of movement in these core areas or these transitional areas, et cetera. I think it's important to start looking at your landscape like that and breaking it down in kind of that manner, because realistically, it isn't just about weather. There's a lot of other indices that are going into this. And I think I'd like to have you on again to talk about more of those indices and factors. And I want to talk about terrain, spatial distribution of deer, male, female, those type of things, and trends that you're seeing kind of across the landscape. So if we can get you on a part two, I know you're super busy. I'd appreciate it. So
yeah, anytime. I'm sorry, I've postponed a couple of times, but it's just the busy part of the season. But I'm happy to come on and talk about this and focus specifically on these things. I can even send you some snapshots of some of the data that I'm talking about and referencing. If you tee up some of those questions for me, I can have that data ready, and I can send it off to you. That way you can share it with your users to kind of contextualize the things that we're talking about, because I think some of it can get abstract. Yeah. Until you're actually looking at the points on a map, and then it starts to make sense.
Yeah. And I got a quick question for you at the end. The fact that you've looked at this data for over 8 years and you're analyzing it and you're kind of contextualizing it, you're humanizing it to some degree as well to make it make sense to you and people around you. Does it almost baffle you? I mean, some of this is happenstance. People kind of walk into these situations. Now, I'm working on properties where we're designing them for movement. But when you're walking into kind of a natural landscape, does it a bit baffle you on the success rates and probability of success, knowing, you know, you can break these things down? A lot of this is instinctual. It'd take a guy like Johnny, even me, and we go at a landscape type and we're starting to break it down. But again, understanding movement patterns and chances and probability, I mean, it becomes kind of daunting, analysis paralysis kind of example. Do you run into that yourself now that you are so knowledgeable and you've seen these trends, but you also know that there's anomalies and there's things that you can't necessarily predict? I mean, how has that impacted you as a hunter?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is when I start looking at some of these mature bucks, it's a wonder that I've ever killed any of them.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of times it's just they're screwing up and I happen to be in the area.
Yeah.
The second thing is I do get some paralysis from analysis, but what I tend to do, and I'm doing it with my app now, and we're building more stuff into the app that's going to help people beat the paralysis by analysis by actually factually showing them, like, hey, you know, you reported best movement on this stand. This is the win that's associated with that. Here's your prediction for these areas. Here are your top three stands. I'll be building that stuff into the application to help people with that. But for right now, I think it's important for you to have like a buddy that's removed from your decision cycle to just kind of help them present them data. It's what I do with my friends. Like, I'll call up Johnny Stewart or someone else and say, here's the three things I'm looking at, you know, help me make a decision here. Then just roll with that person's decision, because I, a lot of times, being the type of thinker that I am, yeah, can wrap myself around the axle where I'm not even making a decision because I can't buy into anything. So I think that's where it's important to have somebody on the horn who can help you make that decision to move through it. If you're anything like I am, which is I absolutely can suffer from that, that paralysis by analysis, but you know, that's what buddies are for, to kind of bounce those things off of. And that's kind of how I've gotten around it. But then when I'm alone somewhere, or I'm doing an out of state hunt, or I'm, you know, a place like that, I just still come up with my, you know, 7 to 10 things that I consider when I'm looking at an area. I will still jot them down in my little engineering book that I take everywhere. And I'll actually just do a cost, you know, essentially what we call in the military, a military decision-making process, a procedural look at what informs your decision matrix, and then make my decision based on that when I write things down. So it's kind of just like writing down the pluses and minuses of a particular area, and then actually stepping away from it for a minute, coming back to it and looking at it and then making your decision, I think is another useful way to do it.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that you have some listeners that are just like us when it comes to trying to get as much info as they need to, because it's part of the fun. It's part of the challenge.
Yeah. I think it's putting the story together and that decision tree analysis that you're talking about, what are those factors, right? So I think next time we can dig into some, you know, Bill Thompson, what his factors are going in, and think about some of your hunts this year that you've been on, and things that you've done in the past that have helped you kind of make it through these decisions. Because I think a lot of people, that's where they're going to struggle. They do not know what to do. They do not it falls apart when the pressure gets hot, and you need to have some real kind of standard practices. Like when I design a hunting property, I have requirements in play before I even get there. I don't even know what the property looks like, but I'm able to diagnose a property because of, you know, my requirements that I've built into my process. It's the same thing. It's all systematic. So I would say in your case, that is the case in concert with the GPS data and other trends and analysis that you've done. So I'm going to let you go because we got a ton of information out of you. I'm going to get you on here again when I can strangle you and find time in your schedule. And then we'll poke you in the eye and get more information out of you. Because I think, to me, this has been awesome. I love having new people on this podcast and a different perspective. And like I said, go check out his app. I think it's a good place to start. And, you know, Bill will tell us more in the future.
All right. Well, I appreciate you having me on, and I look forward to talking again.
All right, man. Talk soon. See ya.
Yep. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.